A Hero's Journey is, by its nature, a podcast filled with spoilers. We recommend reading the book beforehand and then diving into the episode, but proceed at your own risk.
Hi, and welcome to A Hero's Journey, a literary podcast. I'm your host and judge, Jack, and I'm here with my totally tubular twinborns.
This is Alex.
And I'm Zach.
Each week, we look at a different book through Joseph Campbell's monomyth.
This week, we're discussing The Alloy of Law, which is the first book in Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn Era 2 that takes place several hundred years after the events of Mistborn Era 1. We follow Wax, also known as Lord Waxillium, who is a lawman in a world that is very much styled after the Wild West of the United States, with a very similar technology level, trains, carriages, revolvers, but now mixed in with the magic of the investiture of metal that was showcased in Mistborn Era 1 on this same shard world. This story starts out with Wax out in the roughs, which is pretty much the Wild West part of this world, where he is a lawman who's hunting down a notorious criminal who's been kidnapping people and experimenting on their bodies and doing very macabre art displays. During this hunt, he's joined by his girlfriend, Lessie. Lessie is unfortunately captured by this maniac, and in the ensuing kind of violence where Wax is holding a revolver at them, he takes a shot at the bad guy's head, and he moves Lessie's head into the way and puts the bullet straight through Lessie's. This emotional turmoil, as well as the recent death of his uncle, which leaves Wax as lord of an influential household, sends Wax back to Ellendale, which is the capital city of this country, world. There's pretty much only one area where everybody lives, and this is the big city in the middle of it. So he comes back to find that the house that he is in charge of is now destitute due to the decisions that his uncle had made during his lifetime, and he now has a responsibility to not only deal with his own emotional problems, but also repair a house that is in shambles. This all ties together with the fact that there is a group known as the Vanishers, who are stealing cargoes from trains and then disappearing, and also kidnapping various women of influence throughout the city. It has been nagging at the constables who haven't been able to solve it, and Wax takes a particular interest in it. One of the women who gets kidnapped is his fiance, so now he has a vested interest in burning down this criminal organization beyond just his general interest. He pairs up with Wayne, who is a twinborn who has the ability to heal himself as well as slow down time, whereas Wax's metalborn abilities allow him to make himself lighter or heavier, as well as to push off of metallic objects. The nickname is a coin shot. He eventually, with the aid of several other characters, tracks down the Vanishers, kind of sets a trap for them, and is able to defeat their head, who is also a twinborn who has the ability to essentially become invulnerable through instantaneous healing from the burning of gold. It's quite an adventure. He manages to rescue his fiance and bring down the Vanishers, but learns more about a larger plot that's currently being undergone, and we'll get to that in a little bit later.
Coming into our departure, we come to that most regular of events, when you are told that your uncle is dead and you are now the head of your household. That's happened to you guys, right? You're just often told that you're now in charge of like an entire quadrant of a city.
Two or three times. Right. As Jack said, we start with Wax's journey where he gets a letter. He's out in the roughs and he gets a letter from back in Ellendale saying, your uncle has passed. You're now the leader of the house. Come home and start taking care of business. He plans on ignoring this letter. He's going to continue his life as a lawman out in the roughs, doing what he believes he's good at and what he can help people with until the death of Lessie. So our call to adventure is that being called back to this lord of the house, and his refusal is no. He's had that letter for some time, and he's staying out in the roughs, and he's doing his lawman gig. It's not until the death of Leslie, where he gets shook to his core, that he accepts the invitation and therefore launches himself fully into the world of the adventure. I'm going to be using Wayne as the mentor here for the meeting the mentor step. Not only does he save Wax's life on several occasions, he brings him lots of different clues and information, but he starts off this whole case for the Vanishers, if we're to treat this like a detective novel, which in many ways it is. He presents him with an aluminum bullet upon popping into his mansion right before his soon-to-be fiancé shows up and kind of integrates himself into his newfangled life in a way that somewhat vexes Max, but also is a great piece of support for him. For our crossing the threshold, we have letting Wayne discuss the Vanishers, as well as starting to formulate his own theories. There's several instances where he goes originally, oh, I'm not going to kind of get involved, but through Wayne's coaxing of, oh, did you hear about this and this, it starts to slowly kind of pull at the back of his mind and goes, oh, I know you think your life is out of this, but I'm going to pull you right back in. And so he starts to formulate his own theories and get more involved. And then finally, for the belly of the whale, the point at which he can't really go back anymore, he and his fiance go to a wedding for another couple. It's a big wedding party that gets attacked by several dozen of these Vanishers, and during which he ends up engaging in a large gunfight, him and Wayne against several, I think, three dozen or so Vanishers, and at the end of which, Steris, his fiance, is kidnapped, and there's no turning back now. He's fully committed.
Okay, so, Zach, I like the journey to stop Vanishers. I think it's a good one, very evident throughout the whole thing, and as this is essentially a detective novel, there's not really a better way to have a detective novel start than with notice of the Vanishers like we have. So for a cold adventure, my biggest problem with this is that it happens off screen. This isn't something that happens during the book, unless I'm misremembering.
But there's, okay. So it's a bit of half and half, to be honest. There, right at the very beginning, when he's moving through the city, he kills the first, I mean, the town. He kills the first guy, and then
Leslie saves him.
Leslie saves him, and she comments, what are you going to do about that? And that the letter is sticking out of his pocket.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, so, in that case, I guess it's pretty clear, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely prevalent. It just, we don't see the delivery boy drop it off.
And the other thing that I will say that kind of brings it all around is the reveal at the end of the book that his uncle is, in fact, the person financing the Vanishers. I said financing, weird. Financing the Vanishers really makes it hard not to see this as the first move that puts Wax on the board.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's even unbeknownst to him, he's being called back into the story. I don't like this refusal of the call, though, because of what we just talked about. Wax didn't really know that he was called to be Lord for a long time. It's not like he got this note and months later he was still just kicking it in the roughs.
It's implied that it's been some time. I had to hazard a guess, I'd say it's at least a week, probably several.
Well, then I, again, want to go back to the Call to Adventure. I just don't really think that it's refusing the call to continue to investigate other murders. I mean, he had more pressing issues. It wasn't like he was ignoring his duty to the house at this point.
He was... For me, he kind of seems to imply in his musings in that first chapter that he isn't intending to go home. He wants to stay with her. And while I agree with you that it's a little bit odd to have the call happen off screen, theoretically, the fact that it ends up being a part of the bigger picture still sticks it for me. However, I am going to knock Zach the fuck off for the ultimate boon, because, or maybe just the entire journey, when it turns out that he was secretly being manipulated into doing somebody else's dirty work.
I mean, Do you mean Harmony or do you mean Mr. Suit?
No,
both, Mr. but Suit. Mr. Suit. Right. It revealed at the very end of that final conversation with his uncle was like, oh yeah, no, we needed somebody to catch Miles because this was all insurance fraud.
All right. So going on to our mentor, I think by far the weakest point in this departure, I can't view Wayne as a mentor. Wayne is a mentee.
You know, your lifelong mentee who all of a sudden is your mentor because Zach needs him to.
Yeah. Wax literally saved Wayne from being killed. He's taught him how to be a detective. He's bringing him into the world of Ellendale. He's giving Wayne all of the funds he needs and, you know, coming up with the plans. Even in this thing where Wayne is like trying to get him to consider stuff about the Vanishers, Wayne is just giving information to Wax, and then Wax is spitting information like and ideas back to him. In the belly of the whale, Wayne is at the dinner and telling Wax basically, hey, the Vanishers are going to attack here. Wayne doesn't have a plan. Wayne's plan was to have Wax make a plan. How do we consider that
Wayne would argue that that is a pretty good plan. Mostly because Wax is ordained by God to be correct, but...
I agree that Wayne is not necessarily super stereotypical, in fact, because he takes a lot of leads from it. The only other instance that I thought might have been able to fit is that there is a butler whose name starts with a T, who gives a lot of what would seem to be very sagely advice to his employer. But later when he tries to kill him, it undermines it a little bit.
Just a smidge when he tries to kill him.
I genuinely assumed that the butler was a Condra, and I'd read the book before. I'd forgotten that it was actually the butler.
Yeah, the butler is working for Mr. Sue.
Yeah.
Which I don't understand, because if they needed him to do the thing, why are they trying to kill him?
Yeah, it doesn't quite. They don't need Wax to be the one necessarily to stop Miles. He ends up being the person to do it.
They just needed somebody.
Yeah, they needed the aluminum to be. They needed this last shipment to be stolen, and they wanted a few more girls.
My biggest issue with a crossing the threshold is I don't think that that's actually when the crossing the threshold happens. I think the crossing threshold and belly of the whale happen together, because Wax is so resistant to the idea of investigating the Vanishers. He, you know, barely gives any information to Wayne until that belly of the whale, which I think is perfect. I can't think of a better way to introduce you to the quest than to have your fiance kidnapped as well, and you being directly like attacked during that kidnapping. So I think just because the belly of the whale happens like that, I think it's just too close to...
I would be inclined to agree with you, and maybe I'm remembering this wrong, but doesn't it go conversation with Wayne stays up too late trying to solve the mystery anyway, even though he gets rid of Wayne, and then the butler comes in and tells him, sir, you had to fill out all these reports, and he goes, oh, I'll get to them, and the butler goes, it's 3 a.m.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. And he, in fact, is also drawing a bunch of, like, clues on like a big notepad, on a big easel.
Yeah, his totally dead sister's art stuff.
Totally dead sister.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, well, I actually kind of wish that the Wax had remained, or yeah, Wax. I keep seeing Wayne written in front of me. That Wax was actually a little more reluctant to get back in. He pretty much immediately starts crossing the threshold back into being a lawkeeper. Wax the gentleman is just not built to last.
Well, one of the things I think is interesting, and he self-identifies about himself on several occasions, is that in the roughs, he was the gentleman.
Yeah.
And here, but here in the city,
he is the rough. That is going to bring us to a close on our departure with just that mentor missing, because Wax, like several other detective characters, kind of comes pre-built out of the box. Riding in on our horse destroyer, we come to our road of trials.
Yeah, for our road of trials here, like Jack mentioned in our previous section, as a detective, Wax comes fairly well equipped to handle the problems that he's being faced with in this story. But he does get to showcase us to the reader, and this is our first introduction to a character that we're going to be following for several books, on what skills Wax has. And so there's several different instances where he showcases those, the first being tracking down the Vanishers. He's using his sleuthing skills to find clues. He also figures out their motives, that everyone else thinks they're going after the supplies. He figures out that not only are the supplies not what everybody thinks they are, but the supplies are just a cover-up for the kidnapping of women for reasons that they're not entirely sure why at first. They do figure out that it's because they are allomancers in some capacity. Well, sorry, that they have allomancer blood in some capacity. And then finally, there's many instances in which Wax gets into gunfights, fist fights, mostly gunfights, with different people using his allomancy skill. And that showcases not only his combat skill and intuition, but also his allomancy skills as it relates to other people. There's even a line in the story that talks about how in big open combat that numbers will almost always prevail, but once you add cover and smaller spaces, that skill and ability starts to come to the forefront. And I think that's particularly impactful because it does show us that he is good. I mean, him and Wayne take down several dozen people, 25 versus 2. So he is good at what he does. For our meeting with the higher power, I've chosen Marassi, who is the cousin of his bride, Steris. She has several different insights into a lot of different topics that Wax himself is not versed in. She talks about population numbers. She knows more about the inner workings of the city. And yeah, she also has insight into the police force here in the city, something that while Wax had a lot of experience being a lone lawman out in the roughs, he doesn't really know how to interact with the police here in the capital city very well. So she provides a lot of useful insights that help break through in the case. For the Temptress, there's constant reminders of Lessie throughout the stories. In fact, there's instances where he's using his gun, where he's worried about, oh, what if I miss? You know, I haven't really done this since then at the beginning. And then there's instances of when he's comparing Steris to Lessie. And I think what those draw to is not only his relationship with Lessie, but also to his life before returning to the city. So should he become this proper gentleman or should he go back to the roughs? Because there's plenty of people who already think that that's where he belongs, even here in the city. They're not the most welcoming crew. So I think that's that temptation, is to flee back to what he knows, and that's triggered by the constant reminders that pop up of Lessie. For our atonement with the creator, we have a discussion with Harmony. He has a couple scenes where he's praying to Harmony through his spike, but his one moment in particular after they blow open the bank vault. There's a impervious vault that is on a train. Wax puts himself inside of the vault, so when the train gets stopped and the vault itself gets taken off of the train, he is inside of it. And so when they go to open it up, they think he might be in there. He has some dynamite, causes an explosion. And during this, there's a hole that's made in the building and the mists start to flow in. And we all know from Era 1 that the mist is how Harmony can interact with people. And so as well as through the spikes, and in that mist, Harmony tells them, hey, I have been helping you out just like you asked. In fact, lo and behold, and there is his chest of guns that had been taken away by the butler, but are now here in the hideout for the Vanishers. And he's able to arm himself and do battle with the Vanishers in a spectacular way. For our apotheosis, it's interesting because this is a plan that Wax has outlined. It's not him who is having the realization. Everything at least partially goes to plan for Wax, and therefore he ends up, after rescuing Steris, and he's trying to take down Miles, the big bad of the leader of the gang, who is a previous lawman who's nearly impervious to danger due to his unique combination of allomancy and ferrochemy. He's getting beat up by Miles pretty good. It's not until Miles is pretty much done beating him up that he realizes that they are inside a time bubble that's being cast by Maracy, who is able to slow down time for people inside of her little sphere of influence when she burns her metals. So in the meanwhile, while everyone outside of that bubble is going about time at a normal rate, and the police force show up and they surround the bubble, and then once the bubble drops, they take Miles into custody, thereby ending the threat of the Vanishers and rescuing Steris and accomplishing his ultimate boon.
All right, Zach, so let's go with the Road of Trials. I think the biggest issue with the Road of Trials is something we've discussed many, many times, and it's that the character doesn't really develop on these. Wax is already an established allomancer, an established detective, and an established, you know, fighter. So I think while I agree that all of the things he does are challenging, you know, like you said, he does have a hard time tracking down the Vanishers. It is a challenge for him. It's something that he's done before. It's not like he's learning. Yeah, same thing with all of the things, figuring out the motives of the Vanishers and fighting the Vanishers. Something that he's done before, it's not a new skill for him.
He is doing it in a new setting that's unfamiliar to him. So he has to relearn some of the rules, and you know, he's in a place that's so full of metal that he has to get used to flying around there versus out in the roughs.
You know, I wish there was more struggle, and while we are fine with trials that are characters performing great feats in some places, our other detective story that we've covered, Stormfront with Dresden, who was also a fully ready badass detective, he didn't meet his road of trials that was quite similar to this one, and I don't think my opinion's changed. I think, honestly, I don't think Wax has to try very hard to do any of this.
Wrong. Yeah, good. So going on to our higher power with Maracy.
I'd like to apologize to all of our viewers. We're going to continue to call her Marcy because that's just what two of us say in our heads.
Yes. So now that we're talking about Marcy, I feel a little bit more comfortable about this. I think that Marcy does provide some help, but similar to Wayne on our discussion with them, more like a companion than a higher power. She kind of acts more like a mentor in this, with the guiding around the city and the city's issues and different political forces. But also, you know, she looks up to Wayne as this legendary figure.
I think your stronger argument is that she's a member of the gang, because she definitely comes with her own set of skills that are very useful.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest, like, that's a big part of it. And part of the reason why she's part of the gang is because, you know, she thinks of herself as less than. It's like, what, Wax is the leader of the gang. Marcy's just happy to be a part of that gang.
The other thing I've considered was the head of the police force. I don't remember his name, but he's very antagonistic to
being antagonistic is allowed, but
well, I don't think he provides a lot of help to them. So going on to the Temptress then, I don't like this for a lot of reasons. The constant reminders of Lessie don't distract him from what's going on. I think it just kind of, if anything, forces him more into this. It reminds him of his protector role with Lessie that he wasn't able to really fulfill, you know, accidentally shooting her. And it forces him to think more about how he could help Steris, who is less capable of protecting herself from this type of situation than even Lessie would have been.
I will say that it's a little bit early on, but since it isn't part of our refusal, his desire to be a gentleman and not take up the quest comes before our belly, so it's not really a moment for him to he is fully committed and he doesn't really get a chance to give up afterwards. But he does have that secondary moment where he goes, we should call the constables. We don't have to be the ones to deal with this. But once Steris is gone, he doesn't have a crisis of faith. He doesn't have a moment where he goes, I can't beat Miles. Miles is too strong. He's like, I will die taking on Miles.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry, the character has conviction. Gosh.
No, but it's not a flaw with you, Zach. I think it might be a flaw in Wayne in this book. Maybe it's just part of being introduced to him. But I feel like maybe there should have been a Temptress here somewhere. Right? It's not. We could make the real small argument that it's to break his contract with his fiance, but it's not like he and Steris are actually together yet properly. They didn't get their official public coming out.
Yeah, I think kind of what, along with what Jack is saying, when Sanderson originally wrote this, it was written as a one-off. So I think that in the subsequent books, Wax develops more as a character, and there are more tempting things and things that try to draw him away from the quest. But in this one, written as a one-off detective story, there's no real room for a Temptress.
Yeah, I don't think we spend enough time with Wax's flaws. They're there, but they don't really get elaborated, and he's not made to pay for them until later.
So, going on to the Atoma with the Creator, I wouldn't feel good about arguing against someone's literal god talking to them.
Hey,
crisis.
Lowercase g god.
Excuse me. I wouldn't feel good arguing about someone who this character prays to daily, who provides aid in a moment of crisis as much as he possibly can. So,
and is the single most powerful individual in the Cosmere.
So going on to our apotheosis, it's really funny how Miles now is our hero in this instance.
I just wanted to showcase that the book had one.
Shocking apotheosis of the book.
I appreciate what you did. I like it. Just not a thing for Wax.
Though I do want to ask any of our listeners to tweet at us. I'm curious. We might even put a poll up for it. Did you see this one coming? Because it seemed pretty forecast to me throughout the entire book, both the first time I read it and reading back, even more blatant of, her powers are useless. I wonder what they'll do. We've got a backup plan. What's the backup plan? We almost had him. It's meant to be a shocking twist, I guess, but it doesn't really come across that way to me as a reader.
And for our ultimate boon here, this is a detective story, and damn, that's a good ending to the detective story. I can't argue with it.
See, I really think the ultimate boon is when he yeets the gunsmith out of the window.
To save him.
Just the canal.
The most important question I have for you tonight is, can you swim? Boom. And that is going to close us out on our initiation. Much, much spottier than our departure, with Lord Waxillium Landrin only having an atonement with his creator and an ultimate boon. Knowing that this town wasn't big enough for the two of them, but Wax is still standing, we come to our return.
Yeah, for our refusal to return, we have Wax knowing that he's always going to be a lawman, right? He tried to put that part of him aside and could become the lord of his household, but he is fully aware that he's not going to be able to give up this part of himself and live a fulfilling or even a sane lifestyle. And so if he really wanted to return to being, you know, the lord of his house, then he'd give this back up, but he knows that he can't. So that refusal to do so is also his refusal of the return. For our magical flight, we do get a bit of a time jump into the future, in which now they're having Miles' execution and they're giving him a deputyship essentially over the whole city to be an independent lawman, which seems like he's the first person to really get that. So that's a cool little magical flight time jump. We've done that before. From our rescue from without, we have two choices, and they both are the ultimate boon. We either have Marcy's bubble, which directly make the whole ultimate boon possible, or the, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of police officers waiting outside the bubble, ready to take Miles in. Both of those things are his rescue from without, because he's literally getting beat up, and those are the things that save him. For our crossing of the return threshold, we have his discussion with his fiance Steris, who he's rescued, about how his lawman nature is a good hobby. In fact, in the beginning of the book, she talked about how lords are expected to have mistresses, and now she's talking about how lords are expected to have hobbies, and maybe his detectiveness isn't too bad of a hobby, since it literally saved her life. So that's a cool kind of bringing it back for the crossing of the return threshold. For our Master of Two Worlds, we have his now Lord of his House, where he's slowly integrated himself more into the life of the city, and now he's become a recognized lawman of the city. So we have those two worlds that he's managed to smooth together. He keeps his fiance. He's going to, you know, marry her and become and create a house that's once again financially stable. All good stuff. Our freedom to live is he's able to be both of those things. Now, I will preface it with a bit of a downside that he does get to meet that Mr. Suit, the shadow behind the Vanishers, ends up being his not quite dead uncle. And a lot is revealed that implies there is a lot more to come for Mr. Wax, and we'll have to learn more about it next time on Wax and Wayne.
Okay, so let's just go right into it. I don't think refusing... I don't think saying he'll be a lawman is a refusal of return. Just is what he is. You're even using that as part of the Master of Two Worlds, so I just don't understand how it's refusing to return to the world.
Could it be being beaten to a pulp?
Also, no.
A pulp can't be lawmen or noblemen. They can only be juice.
But they can heal.
Sorry.
They can heal.
Again, I think this is one of the bits where this kind of falls a little bit short, because Wax meets no resistance. He immediately goes, oh, I can in fact have it all, even though we don't see him go be a good lord. He just continues to be a lawman.
So magical flight, time jump. This is interesting because this is a external time jump, not an internal time jump. But I don't have any other problem with it. It's just funny. It's the opposite of our usual time jumps.
Oh. Yes, I love when we subvert the tropes.
Yeah. Rescue from without. I mean, I think the constables are probably better rescue from without than Marcy.
Since she was kind of in on it.
Yeah, so... But, you know, you said both of them, so I guess. Crossing the return threshold. This one, I think it's a little bit harder because he's going to Steris, who's been gone since the crossing the threshold moment originally. So maybe it's not as hard as I thought it was. That's actually a nice reflection. Going back to Steris, who's been gone since... essentially are crossing the threshold, really the belly of the whale, and sharing the information with her and his decision to be a lawman.
I think that it really works for me with his decision to go with Steris, especially in the face of the not so subtle offer from Marcy. That it really is him crossing into a new normal, where he will unfortunately then get his fucking Master of Two Worlds, because this is him choosing to be good for his house. This is the only thing we get to see him do all book related to actually being a good lord, but it comes at exactly the right moment.
But freedom to live. Just know, right? Look, Mr. Suit still has his sister trapped, and all the people who were also taken by the Vanishers before Steris. There's something else going on. The mystery isn't done with Miles. The mystery continues from him. We even have the, like, implied, not implied, just outright stated from his uncle, you were helping us with what you did. That's definitely not aligning with the freedom.
Also, I don't know if we can award freedom to live to anyone whose last bit of a book is being thrown off of a train by bad guys. And swearing to get revenge on his uncle who he's hated all along. Also, you know, he's a man who wears an earring with a god that gives it, makes him, doesn't make him do things, but
highly suggests courses of action.
That's going to close us out on our return with just that freedom to live missing, putting Lord Waxillium Landrin at a 10 out of 17, putting him actually way higher than I would have expected for our hard-boiled detective type of story. Not quite reaching our threshold for a modern hero, but pretty damn close.
No, I think the fantasy tropes run very strong in our call, in our departure and return, whereas the hard-boiled detective tropes run very strong in the middle third of the book.
Coming in on our closing thoughts, I think I've already weaved in quite a lot of my overall opinions. Wax and Wayne is a bit of an odd series for me because I read Mistborn, immediately started these, and I no longer remember where I stopped. So I've got vague impressions of a lot of things, but I'm also not sure for farther into the series whether it's because I read it or because I enjoy the Cosmere enough that I've had accidental spoilers trickle into me. So this one was definitely a reread, and there were things that I liked a lot better this time and certain things that fell a little flat. And in general, while I still really liked the writing, the world, everything, I actually found it Wax shallower than I remember. Because, as we've discussed, a lot of that comes from the fact that this was originally a one-off rather than a character we were going to spend four books with.
Oh, that was my point, Jack. That was, like, explicitly my point.
You said it earlier in the podcast as well.
Exactly. I think a lot of the weakness of this book comes from the fact it was written as a one-off and then later changed into a main story, like in the world. And I think we can see from the next book, which is Bands of Mourning. No, that's the third one.
Bands of Mourning is number two.
No, Shadows of Self is number
Shadows
two.
Of Mourning is number three. I do it wrong every time.
Yep. I had to look at my bookshelf. But anyway, I think we can see from how Wax develops as a character in Shadows of Self, and you know, he faces many different struggles than he did in this book, and we see really the depth of his character, whereas it's just hinted at here. You can tell that Sanderson didn't have the full plan here, but does by the time he gets to the second book.
Also, we should say that we're framing these as like bad things, but clearly this character was so good, and even in this shorter, snappier, less expanded book,
he couldn't stop.
Yeah, and I think it's difficult for me reading these series because I do very much like Wax and Wayne, and I do very much like the way that Investiture on this Plane interacts with a Wild West tech, and whether or not that is inherent to the fact that it's still relatively low tech, more mechanical than anything, that it feels almost steampunky in a way, as opposed to, you know, true technological advancement. And maybe I will be pleasantly surprised in Mistborn era 3 and 4 as we pull in, you know, more modern and futuristic technologies, just due to the quality of Sanderson's writing. But I am hesitant as a grumpy old man yelling at clouds while still enjoying what we have here in front of us.
Thank you so much for joining us. If you enjoy listening to A Hero's Journey as much as we love doing it, you can always leave us a review wherever you get your podcast from and hit that subscribe bell or notification button to get notices on when we release new content. As always, I've been your host and judge, Jack.
This is Alex.
And I'm Zach.
And join us next week when we'll be diving into A Brother's Price by Wen Spencer.
Yay!
Hey, everyone. During this episode, we talked about a fair number of Cosmere spoilers, and instead of just cutting it and throwing it away, I decided to cut it and place it all at the end. I think most of it is pretty understandable without any context surrounding it, so I hope you can listen and enjoy it. Thanks.
Are there only two, even in Era 1, are there only two races of people?
No.
There's only Tennismen and others.
There's Terrismen. It's actually weird because there's Terrismen. And then
Kolos
are kind of a actually they distinctly are people that time. Yeah. Now they're their own race, the Kolos blooded. But Terrace is the only place that still gets identified by like a former ethnic group because everyone's still kind of divided into Ska and Noble, and the Terrace are kind of treated as like, I can't remember whether they're technically meant to be Ska or Ska-blooded or not, but they are treated separately. Even though
the only reason I ask is because they're at least in this era, they're and in the previous, their magic powers seem to be directly down. You know, Ferrokemi and Allomancy seem to be split inherently.
Yeah, because Ferrokemi is not actually of any shard. It is a naturally occurring magic that started with the Terrace people on Skedril.
Which is why the people from the Eldraine world are super interested in it. Not Eldraine. I said Eldraine. I meant Elantris.
Elantris, yeah.
Alright.
Because it's a power that... It's a metal... Right, it works as... It is a form of investiture, but it's made by Andalusium rather than any of the shards, so it could work elsewhere.
That's interesting, though, because... Skeladriel was created by
Skeladriel was
by them.
Purely yeah. made, and they're the only, maybe then it isn't, because Skeladriel is right, the people on it are 40% ruin, 60% preservation, and they're actually the only humans kicking around that aren't
from the OG world
that were directly made by shards.
Mm-hmm.
Weird.
Yes.
So where the fuck does Ferrokemi came from? I thought it was.
It comes from the combo of both of them, I thought.
And that ruins is the spiking.
Yeah, he's hemorrhaging. Sorry, I've got to introduce this point and then ignore Zach as he speaks so I can look up Ferrokemi on the Coppermine.
there is, on the Coppermine, there is a thing that talks about how there is a. Like a chart in one of the book's subsections. I didn't actually look at the chart that relates Ferrokemi to some other sort of investiture. So that might be the place to start. yeah, for a refusal of the return, there is a sort of self-realization when this job gets...
It's just the balance between the two.
Ah! Okay.
It result of interactions between them. So it doesn't sound like it was made by anyone, but anyway.
All right, so the Terrismen are 50-50 sort of thing, people. I was just curious, because there's no, like, Kolos magic.
No.
They're just genetically chonky.
You're
going to tell us about Ferrokemi.
You can't prove that. I'm just once again obsessed with the way that Brandon either is the best con man ever for... pretending that he's had everything figured out all along, or actually has like 90% of his shit planned out this far in advance, which is amazing.
I call him Mama Bear Sanderson.
Uh-huh.
And in the next books, literally has long conversations with him.
It's kind of be nice to know that of like everyone in the world, God wants to be your buddy. Also, that God is super bored.
I mean, God is almost... my favorite bits of Harmony in this whole series is when he, like, accidentally tells the Chondra and sometimes the humans about things that are coming, like, technology-wise. He'd be like, if you think this is wild, wait till you hear about movies.
Hey. Look, just because he's gonna be right doesn't mean he actually knows he will. Fortune is... let you see possible paths, Zach.
Yeah.
Though I guess that raises the question of if all roads lead to
movies.
movies, airplanes, and electricity.
Apparently, because he also has, well, at the very beginning of the book, Wax mentions that in the books that Harmony wrote, whatever the, like, that were left there at the end of
the books of, like, the founding.
Yeah. He, like, mentions, like,
electricity. Yeah. But again, if we've got enough time for a minor sidetrack, Alex, I don't know how much time you have. What baffles me is that Fortune lets you see possible futures, and Harmony's like, these things will happen. Give it time. And it's like, well, we know that Stormlight Era 2 involves... Odium has got machinations that involve the people of Roshar with surge binding as they currently are, helping him take down the other shards. Shouldn't there be like
era two for Stormlight?
Yeah, first five books are going to be one era. Second five books are going to be another era.
Split by like 20 years, Zach.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Not, it's not going to be a massive time jump, which means.
But the cast is going to remain relatively.
Oh, yes. You can look at who the main point of view for each book is, and they're all currently people we've met.
Oh, Yasna, Lyft, Renarin, Ash, and the Crazy Herald.
Yeah, Talano.
Interesting.
Can be weird from Ash's perspective as well. But yeah, with that and the fact that means that we're going to have to see Odium's plans come together in what is presumably not long, right? Our current understanding is that Wax and Wayne is taking place roughly at the same time as Stormlight Era 1, right?
Really? I thought that because we saw the spaceships come to the bird planet, and that the bird planet, the birds are already on shoulders of people in Stormlight, that Stormlight was taking place at the same time as space level Mistborn.
No, the by Wax and Wayne 4 has to be written before book 5 of Stormlight, is because something from Wax and Wayne 4 is going to influence something in Stormlight 5.
Yeah, we know Hoyt at the wedding was. Is the same Hoid that's running around.
I mean, they're all the same Hoid.
Yeah, but like chronology. Yeah, he's bouncing between the worlds.
He gives Wax the Kelsier coin, doesn't he?
Not in this one, and in one of the other ones.
Yeah, is that book two or book three? But
I think it's three. But anyway, there's a specific period of time where Hoyt is gone from Stormlight, and that's when he's in Wax and Wayne, at least one in, like, 1, 2, 3.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, but then how come in Bird?
Because that story, not everyone is technical, right? A lot of the universe is technologically stagnant, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the classic magic problem where if you can do things tapping into investiture, you might not want to advance technologically.
Well, I guess the point I'm making is that then the birds that can sense investiture that the characters have in Stormlight, some of the secret society people,
one of them has one.
No, there's a fight of the birds in like the fourth book.
Yeah, in Rhythm of War. Are both of those the same type of bird? I thought they were two different kinds of birds.
I mean, they're from the same plane, but I think they're two different. Bird, same planet.
Oh yeah. So yeah, we have two of them.
So all I'm saying is that they must be traveling to that world in this time period, just not the spaceships.
We just there are ways to travel to non-shard worlds, I believe. I'm not sure how you transfer without a perpendicularity, but
there are perpendicularities on the planet.
Yeah.
Is the bird planet the one with the guy who breaks himself into avatars?
Yeah, the autonomy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then autonomy is weird anyway. But So I'm confused. No one has given me an answer for why Harmony's ability to view the future isn't just a bunch of shit going wrong.
Oh. I guess the point I was going to make to that originally was that he might not know that who's going to make electricity. He just knows that electricity is imminent.
No, he progresses society. He has knowledge about the society, about like technology and stuff, and he progresses society slowly,
intentionally, like inspires people to breakthroughs.
Yeah, as part of keeping his balance in the world. They've got to advance, but they've got to advance at the right pace.
The future he sees isn't like this events are going to happen. It's like, well, I know how to make this technology because reasons, and I'm just going to slowly leak it out to people. That's the kind of future he sees.
Yeah, Harmony is not meant to be very good at seeing the future, isn't he?
No.
It's cultivation that is. Anyway, enough of that. We could do this for days. Well, what I think is kind of fascinating on that front, we can cut this out if we need to, but Roshar is so much more mage-punky than this world. Roshar is all about, like, using its magic investiture as its fuel for its technologies versus they basically, right, you talk about it as steampunky, but they don't, because Allomancy, Ferrochemy, and not that they use much hemorrhagy, but all that stuff is relatively rare. Most of its society has just developed quite normally, and then there are people running around with magic powers, but there's no right electricity is powered by dedicated
people stepping up and down
coin shots, right, pushing things, because the Allomancy is end positive, so you get more energy out than you put in, so you could use it as a viable energy making source.
One thing that we haven't ever discussed, I don't believe, is does Harmony create metal in the world at a...
Or are they losing it?
will they eventually run out of steel and silver? And
I think we've been Rafa'd on that. I'm not certain. We know that he's no longer making adium, and there's no more naturally forming lysarium anywhere on the planet.
Yeah, I just mean even on the stuff like gold. Like, eventually you run out of gold. Eventually.
Yeah, maybe. So, I don't think we know. Maybe that's why they take to the stars. Maybe there's not enough metal.
That could be. Or, you know, they could have to advance technology because they just run out of magic.
We know that he is making harmonium.
Yeah.
Or et metal, or whatever they call it. Sasdium.
What does he mean? Weapons out of?
We don't know. We just know that Southern Scadrial, it's alkali, so you can't ingest it or touch it.
Oh, you can't. So that makes sense.
But we know that it will. It's part of Southern Scadrial's more advanced tech stuff.
It's very transistor.
Also, we still don't know what one does with. There's a goddamn compound for Lysarium, and we will never find out what it is, because Saz will never have reason to make more.
We've also talked about how the fact that there's Harmonium means that there's a metal for every shard.
We know that. The Honor Blades are made out of Raysdium, which name may need to change. They haven't been clear about that. If the shard state, right. Harmonium
is Honor's metal?
No, Raysdium is Odium's metal.
Why are the Honor Blades made out of it?
No, the Honor Blades are made out of Honor's metal. They just didn't call it Tanavastium.
Oh, okay. So then what's made out of Odium's metal?
The blades that it draw investiture out of things when you stab them.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And we don't think that the talking blade is made out of any
Nightblade is not made of god metal, we don't think.
It's just the investiture of the thousands of souls.
It is made out of some combination of atium.
Oh, okay, it has atium in it.
I am pretty sure.
It has something to do with ruin, now that you say like it. That
it's some kind of humorology. I can just look at Copper Mind.
Nightblood was not originally a metal mind or a hemorrhagic spike.
That'd be interesting.
Nightblood could bond a spren, but the circumstances required to do so would be so weird that it's never going to happen.
So he has a soul then, right? Don't you need a soul to bond a spren?
if Nightblood was a magic card, it would be an equipment with text: when equipped creature does combat damage, destroy all other creatures. During your upkeep, pay Wooburg or lose the game.
When it deals combat damage, destroy all other creatures.
Yay! Oh, thank you.
I'm just remembering how good the moment is when they're all sitting there and Wayne goes, "Hey, Wax, you said they want to kidnap a bunch of the..." Or maybe it's Marcy. "You said they want to kidnap a bunch of the women that would be in this room right now?" Oh.
Doors break down.
Again, yeah. I just want to imagine that Miles is sitting there with a little, like, ear amplifier, so that way he can get his timing right.
Oh, it's just like in the Grisha when the guy breaks through the party.
Yep.
"You mean you left the border open?" Crash. Alarm sounds.
Oh.
Yeah.